Exodus is a wonderful story, and as we said, particularly in the early sermons, it's a book and it's a story through which God is revealing himself. And you get that phrase throughout the book, so that they may know that I am the Lord. It's through his acts, particularly his acts of salvation, that God is revealing who he is. As we sang, he is a mighty, mighty Savior. And particularly, he is saving his people from slavery, and he's saving them for relationship with himself, that they might be his people, a blessing to the nations. What's the story of Exodus? Let me give you 12 words. 12 words that kind of pick up the key events through the book of Exodus, and you're going to learn them so that you have the book of Exodus in your mind. So these are the 12 words. I'll write them up on the board. All right, misery, Moses, plagues, Passover, sea, song, moaning mountain, covenant calf, glory, gazebo. So let me just unpack that slightly for you. So the story begins in misery. God's people, if you remember, are slaves in Egypt under the oppressive regime of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh goes so far as to order the death of all the Israelite baby boys. God's people cry out in their misery, and God hears them and is concerned for them. We then learn about one of these baby boys called Moses and how he's saved from death through the waters of the Nile, if you remember the basket. And Moses ends up being brought up in Pharaoh's own palace, of all places. And then God appears to Moses at the flaming bush, as we just had read. And God tells Moses that he's concerned for his people. He's going to come and rescue them. And he's sending Moses to Pharaoh. So Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, God says, the God of the Israelites, let my people go. Pharaoh refuses, hardens his heart, says, no way. And so the showdown is set up. And there are 10 plagues as God reveals his superior power and persuades Pharaoh and the Egyptians to let his people go. Anyone remember what the plagues are? There are 10 of them. Second. No, it doesn't have to be in order. Locusts, darkness, blood, the Nile turns to blood, hail, boils. Yeah, we'll come to that. Death of livestock. There are some more insects, gnats and flies. Yeah. Frogs, yes, that's the one I forgot this morning. Nice. I think that's all, 9. The final plague is the worst, the death of the firstborn. All the firstborn sons in Egypt die. God puts them to death. But all the Israelite firstborn sons are kept safe because they sacrifice a lamb in the place of the firstborn son. They paint the blood of the lamb on the doorposts of their houses. And when God passes through Egypt, he sees the blood as the sign that a sacrifice has been made. God passes over those houses. So it's called the Passover. And that finally persuades Pharaoh to let God's people go. They leave Egypt, 1 million or more people. And then almost immediately, Pharaoh changes his mind again, hardens his heart, starts chasing after the Israelites. And then we find the Israelites at the edge of the Red Sea, and they're trapped with the Egyptian army closing in. But God parts the Red Sea, and the Israelites pass through on dry land. And then God brings the sea back on the Egyptian army, and they are destroyed. The Israelites are so happy, they sing a song. We didn't spend much time on that, but chapter 15, they sing a song to celebrate God's victory over their enemies and his mighty salvation. They come into the desert, but it's almost immediately they start moaning. They're in the desert, there's no food, there's no water, and God miraculously provides with manna and quail and water in all kinds of amazing ways, and they keep grumbling and moaning, but God finally brings them to the mountain, and that's where we got last week. And that was, if you noticed it in the reading we had, God's promise that Moses would bring the people out and bring them to this mountain. They arrived there at Mount Sinai, and there God constitutes them as his people and forms a covenant, a relationship with the Israelites. And while Moses is up the mountain receiving the instructions of this covenant relationship, the rest of the people are down the bottom of the mountain forming a golden calf, an idol that they then bow down and worship. in place of God, God is not too pleased, and no sooner is the covenant formed than it is broken. But God is compassionate. Moses is persistent in praying for his people, and God reveals his glory to Moses on the mountain, and Moses says, "This is great. Oh, that your glory would remain with us always." And God says, "Okay," and gives Moses instructions to build a tabernacle, a tent, where his presence would be amongst his people as they journey through the wilderness. Gazebo, tent, tabernacle. All right, that's the story. So, can you learn these 12 words? Say with me. Misery, Moses, plagues, Passover, sea, song, moaning, mountain, covenant, calf, glory, gazebo. Now, obviously, we've got to about here so far, mountain. We've got to the mountain, and we're beginning to get some of the covenant. We might come back to Exodus later in the year. But is that helpful? As you say those words, you can kind of think of the story as you go through. Do you want to try and learn it? Yes. Say it again, looking at it. Misery, Moses, plagues, Passover, sea, song, moaning, mountain, covenant, calf, glory, gazebo. All right. Can you still see it? All right, let's go again. Misery, Moses, plagues, Passover, sea, song, moaning, mountain, covenant, calf, glory, gazebo. Awesome. Well done. Okay. I'm going to stop talking and let you guys share ways in which you've been encouraged, challenged, ways that God's been speaking to you, and how you are responding to all of that.
I started writing some things down and then I ran out of time. So it's just going to be a little jumble of thoughts. But I was really struck by that Exodus 14, the Red Sea, crossing the Red Sea, and when they're standing there and they see the Egyptians coming and they totally freak out. And Ben talked about fears and idols and what you're fearing and what your dominant reality is. And that has been helpful for me. I was thinking that sort of the two fears, God and idols, one is chaotic and one is peaceful. So kind of the fear and love of idols is like a slavery. So they come out of Egypt, but they're still enslaved. They're still fearing the Israelites. I mean, the Egyptians. It's a constant chasing and disappointment and of a carrying of a hope that they can't meet these idols, because they're not the true God. Whereas compared with the fear of God, which is a peaceful fear and logical, the verses that struck me. Verses 13 and 14 of chapter 14, Moses answered the people, so when they see all the Egyptians coming, "Do not be afraid, stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, you need only to be still." That end bit has been really sort of on my mind, just obviously lots of caveats, the Lord will fight for you, but God, if one is trusting in God and he's my dominant reality and he's my hope, then there's a peacefulness, there's a sitting stillness to sitting still or be still. There's a, I think a lot in my life is just a kind of chasing around because I'm fulfilling idols or trying to get them to be what I want them to be, and rather than just finding peace in sitting still and letting him be my God.
I've been reflecting as well on what I've been learning, and I found so much of what we've covered in Exodus helpful, but actually I think it was the very first sermon we had, in Exodus, the Lord of Unstoppable Promises was really significant for me. And Ben talked about what we do when it feels like God's absent or silent. And he said that when God seems absent or silent, We need to trust that he is present, working behind the scenes. And the example of that was that little of God's activity that he was doing from when Moses was taken as a baby and raised in Pharaoh's palace would have been seen for 80 odd years more than that, even until the people were free. And so looking back, they could say, well, God always had a plan, but in the midst of it, it maybe didn't feel that way. And I think Ben talked about the example of China and the fact that, you know, in the midst of oppression there, God's word was going forth and people were turning to faith, even though at the time it wouldn't have felt that way. And it's only looking back that we can see that. And I think that's been a real encouragement for me as I've thought about our city and our church as well, that it can feel a bit like what's going on, what's happening. But there's an encouragement there that God is working. He's not absent and he's not silent. And I pray that we're going to look back in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years and say, well, that's what God was doing. That's who he was raising up. That's how he was growing us as a people. So that was a real encouragement for me.
So I don't know how many of you know, but I'm studying at Bible College at the moment, although that's not quite true. I'm on a break. I did the Old Testament subject last semester, really amazing. And we went through all of the Pentateuch, including the historical books. And I had to do my assignment on Exodus, Exodus chapters 1 to 3. And so when we were doing Exodus as a church, once I'd completed my assignment, it was a reaffirmation, I think, of what I'd already learnt through reading Exodus. And basically, my assignment asked, how does Exodus 1 to 3 fit in the book as a whole? And I had to read the whole book and try to figure out basically how it fit. And if you didn't have 1 to 3, what would you miss? It was a really amazing experience. But I think the main things that God put in my heart was the idea of covenant and God's name. So in the beginning of Exodus, in chapter 1, you don't really see much of that happening. However, you can see that Exodus kind of follows on from Genesis because the people of God have grown in number and they're in a foreign land, and that's a promise of Genesis being fulfilled there. But then they're given this hard labor, and yet God is still remembering his people and caring for them. And then you go into chapter 2 and there's this Levite couple that then have a baby, and he is brought up in the royal house. But it's not, I think, until chapter 2, verse 23 and 24, that you really, I think, see and know what's going on behind the scenes. I'll just read out the verses to you because I found them helpful. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered their covenant, his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God looked on the Israelites and was concerned for them. So I think covenant is a really big part of chapters 1 to 3, and also the book as a whole. As Ben was saying, covenant happens again on Mount Sinai when God establishes the law. And then they break the covenant by making this calf, and then he establishes another covenant again. So covenant just keeps coming up again and again. And it's, I think the main thing I got out of that was God is faithful to his promises and faithful to his people. And no matter how many times we reject him again and again and again and forget him, he's concerned about us and he's faithful and he keeps his promises to us.
I think a standout that I found is probably moaning. That was, I think Henry spoke on that with the grumbling of the Israelites. And, how often we can catch ourselves kind of complaining about things and normalising it and forgetting or dismissing the heart that's behind it that does you know, show a lot of dishonour or a lack of gratitude and thankfulness or contentment in our God. I think it's something that I guess as Christians we sort of like, we've acknowledged the need or the importance of being thankful, and we talk about different habits and practices that can aid a behaviour modification of thankfulness. But I think in that sermon and illustration of the Israelites grumbling and Moses then strikes the rock, and then from the striking of the rock came flowing water, and linking that to how, you know, our grumbling heart is reflective of our sinfulness, and our grumbling hearts can't be fixed without fixing the sin. And but our sinfulness is deserving of judgment and needs to be, you know, needs to be struck or dealt with. But just relating that to the fact that Jesus took on our judgment and he took on that strike on the rock, but from him taking on our punishment on the cross and that strike came flowing waters of life, and in his waters of flowing life comes our satisfaction and our contentment and our joy. And I think as someone who identified as previously being good at practicing habits of thankfulness, but currently in a season where those habits have just been abolished and persistently seeing my grumbling heart come into effect and not being able to behaviour modify that, I think it's revealed my heart that's ever so sinful, and it's uncomfortable seeing that continuously revealed. But having, I think, that image of a rock that has been struck and water flowing from it, I can find rest and joy in that image of knowing that that's what Jesus has done with my sinfulness and grumbling heart. And I can rest in knowing that whilst I see my failures continuously and don't like it, I can come back to him and know that he will continue to provide flowing waters and continue to take on the judgment of my past, present and future sin in that. So I think that's been an image that has really stuck in my mind, has continued to help diagnose my heart and treat my heart before I've seen behaviour change. But I continue to hope that God and Holy Spirit will change outward fruit behaviour, so there's not as many weeds and bad rotten fruit hanging around.
I've been loving in Exodus just how much gospel there is. So much of the grace of God for us in Exodus. And there are so many ways that you can see it. But one of the things that I was reflecting on was just the way you see God's power contrasted with human weakness. How so often you seem that it looks like God was taking the Israelites into a position where they were completely vulnerable, completely weak, like when he takes them out of Egypt and then basically gets them trapped between the Egyptian army and the Red Sea. And it looks like absolute foolishness from our perspective. It looks like they're weak and in trouble and are ready to be run over, and yet God comes and he uses those moments, uses that moment in order to demonstrate his strength and his power so that all may know that he's God. And I was just thinking and reflecting on 1 Corinthians. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And I think we just see that almost played out every week. The weakness of the situation, the weakness of the Israelites, and yet God stepping into the impossible situation and providing the rescue. And for all of those things are actually pointing and resonating with what happens in the cross, where Jesus comes down to earth, gives up heaven, allows himself to be captured, and allows himself to die. It's utter foolishness. It's ridiculous. It's complete and utter weakness. And yet God used that in order to save us and to bring us through. And then I think the implications for us are just incredible. The passage goes off in 1 Corinthians. God chose what is low. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. And God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And I just think on a personal level, just how amazing that is to know that my weakness, when I get frustrated with myself, when I get things wrong, when you fall into sin again, knowing that God has saved and that he's working powerfully despite myself. As I look at the church, where we're at the moment, looking at the weakness of the church and thinking of almost the impossibility of the situation, and that actually this is exactly the moment that God works to demonstrate his power. And I think of us in society, where the church is at large, where we are now in a weak position for a whole range of reasons, some self-inflicted, some not. But actually, these are the moments that God works. And so going through an Exodus and just seeing that happen time and time and time again, and then knowing that this is the gospel, God using the weak things in the world in order to demonstrate his power.
I think Exodus has been a bit of a personal challenge for me because every week's been a different kind of challenge, so I could go on any kind of random tangent here, but so it starts with the calling of, my personal challenge. Well, actually, no. It starts with the story of the midwives. So these two women, or three, I think, are named, randomly doing their jobs and end up getting named in the Bible. I think sometimes we idolize the idea of going on mission or, you know, working in full-time ministry. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But I think sometimes when you're sitting in an office looking at spreadsheets, talking to people about, you know, whether or not they can afford a microscope, it's easy to think, what's the point of all of this, even though I actually love my job, but does this have a context in eternity? And three women doing their jobs, helping people give birth, and they ended up having their names put in the Bible. So don't undermine what God can do, and he needs us out in the secular world as well. Then he calls Moses, and Moses' response is basically, yeah, could you send someone else? And that is my preferred answer to pretty much anything. So just a challenge that, yeah, God does use you whether you feel like you're ready to be used or not. And go with the calling and trust him. Don't trust, but I don't know how to speak, or I don't know how to X or Y or Z, or I'm not comfortable in the situation, and just go with it and let God deal with it. And then God earning people's trust throughout. So Moses was, you know, taking care of sheep and saw a bush that was on fire but not burning. And he got curious. And from that moment on, God talked to him and earned his trust and used Moses to earn the trust of the Israelites as well. And so God is trustworthy, but I'm more like Moses and the Israelites, where, okay, so you turned my stick into a snake. Can I trust that you will send the plague of locusts you promised? Can I trust that you'll turn the river into blood? If I threaten Pharaoh with this, will you follow through for me? And then when the Israelites are out in the desert, okay, you let us out, but now we're trapped at the Red Sea. Can you get us out of this? And then we cross over, great, we sing a praise song, and then we end up in a place where the spring is full of salty water, and then you turn it sweet for us. And then just to show off, you take us to Elam, where there are seven springs and beautiful water, just because you're God and you're showing off. But then we end up in the desert again, and we're hungry and thirsty, and we don't trust you. And that is so me. That is so me. Like, every time there's a change in my life, every time there's a thing that's changing, I stand there and I go, yeah, but, you know, my job's changing. How am I going to pay my bills? I'm moving house. Will I be able to afford the mortgage? I'm, you know, making new friends. Will they hurt me? Whatever it is. Like, I don't trust God as much as I should, even though he has earned my trust from the day I met him. And it was a challenge to kind of know. First of all, a comfort to know I'm not the first, but a challenge to know that he is trustworthy and I need to trust him more.
Thanks, everyone, for sharing. That's really encouraging for me. I was going to try and lead us in prayer and kind of bring all those things that have been shared into one concise, clear prayer. I'm not going to do that. It'd be great to pray where we sit with the two or three around us. And it might be something that's been shared that's struck a chord with you and you want to just turn that into a prayer of response to God. It might be something else that hasn't been shared that's on your heart. But good to now, at this point, as we kind of pause in our way through Exodus, we've been reminded of some of the good things God has taught us, to respond to that, to ask for his help, to be people who do trust his unstoppable promises, who really believe that he's able to work in and through our weakness, who don't persist in grumbling, but are more consistent in our faith in his goodness and provision. So we'll take 5 minutes, just where we're sitting. Turn and pray with the people around you.